Today is Friday, September 10th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, UN alleged the Taliban are harassing its staff.
We are, however, increasingly worried by the growing number of incidents of harassment and intimidation against our national staff.
Plus, U.S. marks 9/11 anniversary on Saturday.
I think until COVID, it really had. But then COVID hit, which was similar in some ways because all of a sudden the city, at least in the early days of 9/11, was dead.
Also, UN accuses international community of abandoning Yemen civilians. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Thursday the al-Qaeda extremist group that used Afghanistan as a staging base to attack the United States 20 years ago may attempt to regenerate there following the American withdrawal. Austin spoke in Kuwait City at the conclusion of a four-day tour of Persian Gulf states. He said the United States is prepared to prevent an al-Qaeda comeback in Afghanistan that would threaten the country. The Taliban gave al-Qaeda sanctuary while it ruled Afghanistan from 1996 to 2001. The U.S. invaded and overthrew the Taliban after it refused to turn over al-Qaeda leaders following the September 11, 2001 attack on the United States. During the 20-year U.S. war, al-Qaeda was diminished, but questions have arisen about its prospects with the Taliban back in Kabul. The UN Special Envoy to Afghanistan says its Afghan staff are being increasingly subjected to harassment and intimidation since the Taliban came to power last month. Diplomat Deborah Lyons on Thursday told the Security Council that UN premises had largely been respected, although there were some exceptions. An internal UN security document seen by Reuters on August 25th described dozens of incidents, including veiled threats, the looting of UN offices and physical abuse of its staff since August 10, shortly before the Taliban swept to power. While Islamist militants have sought to reassure Afghans and Western powers that they will respect people's rights, reports of reprisals have undermined confidence.
We are, however, increasingly worried by the growing number of incidents of harassment and intimidation against our national staff. We will continue to do everything possible to support our staff and keep them from harm's way. The UN cannot conduct its work, work that is so essential to the Afghan people, if its personnel are subjected to intimidation, fear for their lives, and cannot move freely.
That's UN Special Envoy in Afghanistan, Deborah Lyons. The UN Human Rights Office has condemned the Taliban's violent crackdown on peaceful protests in Afghanistan, where women in particular are trying to uphold their rights in the face of the Taliban restrictions on women's place in society. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Despite the risks, Afghan women and men have taken to the streets in defense of their human rights. UN monitors say women have been pressing for their right to work, to freedom of movement, to education, and to exercise their right to participate in public affairs. UN Human Rights Spokeswoman Ravina Chandasani says those rights, which are protected under international human rights law, have been met with a severe response by the Taliban.
We've seen the use of live ammunition, albeit there are reports that you're firing into the air in an apparent attempt to disperse the protesters. Protesters have still been killed. There have been reports of severe beatings as well. And we've also received reports of house-to-house search operations to try to identify those who attended certain protests.
This week, the Taliban reportedly banned so-called unauthorized assemblies and ordered telecommunications companies to switch off internet service on mobile phones in specific areas of the capital, Kabul. Chandasani says her office has received credible reports of women's rights activists and journalists covering protests in the country being arbitrarily arrested and savagely beaten. She says four deaths have been confirmed, although that number is likely to be higher.
The Taliban are currently in control of Afghanistan, and we are calling on them to abide by the obligations under international human rights law that Afghanistan is bound by. It is very crucial that they do not resort to the use of force. It is in no one's interests, really, to see this kind of bloodshed on the streets. It is not going to help to consolidate or to stabilize society.
What would help, she says, is an inclusive approach where the Taliban rulers listen to the grievances of the people. She urges the Taliban to allow the Afghan people to exercise their right of freedom of assembly and to demonstrate peacefully out on the streets. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
On Saturday, the United States marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on the country. Longtime journalist Adam Phillips was part of the team of VOA reporters, editors, and engineers covering the attacks and their aftermath. He was on ground both here in Washington and then in New York, his hometown. Today, we bring you the second part of his conversation with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about his work in those days. They start this part of their discussion by talking about how Phillips coped with the devastation of a city he loves.
In a kind of a sneaky way, and this is one of the drawbacks of the kind of journalism that I do, I had to distance myself a little bit in order to ask the questions and get the sound bites that I needed to tell the story. So it gave me a little bit of distance. If I didn't have any role in this, then it would have been much more difficult because it would have just been this gaping maw of questions and anger and grief and all that. But I was able to process it through conversations with people who were themselves processing it in the first person. And so that gave me a little bit of safety and protection. One thing that was really, really novel and new for me in my perception was that New York is a huge city, very, very, very diverse and busy and lots of money and different groups, etc. But I'd always seen it more as like a machine. I'd never seen it really as a living thing. I felt like the city itself was like really hurt. I'd never thought of a city as its own being in a way that could be hurt, that could be vulnerable, that could be wounded. And so that was a real shift for me to realize that I love this place. And in a way, the place, you know, has its own personality, agency, history, and heart. And that was a real opening for me. And I never lost that.
You mentioned earlier the issue of the toxic debris. Now, scientists have discovered, doctors have discovered that toxic debris, it actually proved to be quite dangerous to many of the people who were down near ground zero for prolonged periods. You yourself were one of the victims of that. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened to you and what you know of what's happened to others?
For one thing, I was near ground zero a lot, just reporting, like those people I told you about who were taking all the material and the debris from ground zero proper, right? So that was already exposing me to a lot. But the VOA Bureau, you know, the offices of VOA, when I would go back, didn't exactly overlook ground zero, but it was, you know, maybe like half a kilometer away or something. I mean, we could see it clearly from the windows. And so we were breathing the air all that time. My engineer, Preston, he got terrible cancer from that. I think it was kidney cancer or something. I forgot now. Somebody else had developed terrible chronic asthma. But these can sometimes take quite a while to surface and push through a thing called the Victims Compensation Fund to pay people or their survivors to compensate them financially for some of the stuff that happened to them. And indeed, in 2017, I developed lung cancer. And then I just got prostate cancer last year.
Now, I want to talk a little bit. You were talking about New York as a living organism almost. Has it recovered? Has its heart recovered?
The first was the economic recovery. I mean, there was so many, all the downtown was so devastated. It was like small businesses, everything was shuttered, et cetera, not to mention the health risks. And I think that slowly it did. It sort of like, remember those old movies of the train starting and that wheel would turn and then start turning faster and faster and faster until it was chugging along? I think until COVID, it really had. But then COVID hit, which was similar in some ways because all of a sudden the city, at least in the early days of 9/11, was dead.
That was journalist Adam Phillips, who retired this year after 28 years of reporting around the world for VOA. He was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson. As the U.S. approaches the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Americans are recalling their personal memories of that horrible day. Ahmed Fati, an Egyptian-American UN correspondent, was then an economist at a Wall Street company in New York. He shared his memories of the attacks as an eyewitness with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
When it happened, I had to deal with a mixture of contradicting feelings, but I can summarize them now into feeling of anger, feeling of fear, and feeling of anxiety. Anger, because this happened to my city, where it have impacted the lives of people that I have known. My wife lost cousin at the World Trade Center, who was working in a financial institution there. Feeling of fear for my personal safety and feeling of anxiety that this attack will happen at any point. You know, in New York City, we depend on public transportation, and the subway is the main mean of transportation. A feeling that I had translating the fear and anxiety, when you get to the subway station and you're standing on the platform, you used to stand casually since 9/11 and the fear that we were living in, you always look to where can you cover your back so nobody would come from behind you and push you in front of the train. That was one of the fears we had. A feeling of anger when I learned that it was supposedly Muslims that committed this heinous crime. It contradicted with everything I was brought on. As a Muslim, I grew up in Egypt, predominantly a Muslim country, but back then also it was quite a different Islam and a different Egypt. Another feeling, anxiety. You're walking in the street, you don't know who's following you. As a city and as an individual, the feelings that was prevalent in America across the board, that a feeling of anger and vengeance, that was our first instinct. And this is quite normal. Maybe we look to it differently now. But I cannot, since we are now talking about the withdrawal from Afghanistan after 20 years, etc., and some of the opinions that say, advocating that it was not a needed war. I beg to differ. The U.S. going to Afghanistan was a needed, much needed war. Americans needed closure. Perhaps this closure never materialized. But looking in hindsight, that perhaps when Osama bin Laden was finally caught and executed, that there would need to revamp the policy towards Afghanistan. This unfortunately never happened.
So how did the terrorist attacks impact your personal life as an immigrant from a Muslim country to the United States?
When 9/11 happened, I was in America for about 5 years. Back then, I didn't get citizenship because my paper was delayed to get my final citizen status. Why? Because my first name is Ahmed and my middle name was Muhammad. This was, sadly, a red flag for the immigration authorities in America. This was also one of the impact. Jobs, economy. I had a very nice working environment, working in a prominent place on Wall Street. Yet all this happened, we were the first out of the door. That caused a shake in our personal confidence. You would be walking in the street in your neighborhood, and maybe some people know or know somebody who knew you and knew that you come from the Middle East and you have a Muslim name. You would be hearing curses in your back. You just had to play that never that you heard us or anything, or even that you speak English at some points. A very traumatic experience. I don't think that we be able to get over it. Maybe it will take some more years. But as a witness, as a person who have been impacted on all levels, emotionally, psychologically, professionally, economically, there had to be a review after all this, an evaluation of what happened and its impact on us.
That's Ahmed Fathi, an Egyptian-American UN correspondent, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. The Pentagon is gearing up to mark the anniversary of 9/11 with a somber event in Washington. For more, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Bob.
The Pentagon, every year at sunrise, they unfurl a U.S. flag over where the plane hit in the Pentagon. So that will happen first. And then they have a ceremony that starts around 9 o'clock. And the ceremony always includes the Secretary of Defense, members of the family. It's a very private moment for the family throughout the day. And so this is the one public show that the Pentagon does to honor those who died that day inside the Pentagon and on the plane. So the Secretary of Defense will speak. There's a moment of silence the time the plane hit on September 11th, 9:37 a.m. And then after that, the families will be left alone. They'll have that time to reflect. And they do that intentionally because they do not want the families to be hounded by members of the media. They know what this day means to those families. And so this is their time.
Usually, what is the mood during this anniversary as the days and years roll in?
It's very somber every year. It never gets to a point where you don't stop and pause and think, oh my goodness, did this really happen? But it really happened 20 years ago. And all of the people who died, I think of the youngest, Dana Falkenberg, she was on the plane with her parents when it hit the Pentagon. She was just 3 years old. She'd be 23. She'd be an adult. You know, she could be living her life. And instead, that moment of terror happened, ended her life, and how senseless that was. And at the Pentagon, it's even more personal. arsenal because the Pentagon went to war shortly after to get revenge for these attacks. And it took the Pentagon 10 years to find and kill Osama bin Laden, but they did that. And now we're at a point where the war has ended. And the part that hurts for many military members is that they went and toppled the Taliban, who harbored the Al-Qaeda terrorists who are responsible for this attack. They toppled them relatively quickly back in 2001, but they never could keep them from coming back. And the State Department and the U.S. government never could get a government and a military in place that could push the Taliban out. And so here we are 20 years later, some of the same members of the Taliban that were leading in 2001 are now in control of the country again. And so it's very hard. It's complicated, is what some of the soldiers told me, because on the one hand, they are happy, they're relieved that the war is over, but they are not exactly happy with how it ended. They're happy that they were able to keep the U.S. safe from another terror attack emanating out of Afghanistan for 20 years, but they worry what's going to happen next.
The next 9 months will determine the fate of 20 people on trial for the 2015 terror attacks in Paris. Of the 10-man team believed to have carried out the coordinated assault, just one is still alive. Salah Abdeslam was among the 14 suspects in court for the start of the trial that could see him in prison for life. Six suspects have yet to be found and arrested. For VOA from Paris, Maria Galivan reports on what is ahead.
There was tight security as the accused arrived at the Paris courthouse for the start of the 9-month trial. 20 people are charged in connection with a series of attacks on November 13, 2015, that left 130 people dead and more than 350 injured. Six are still on the run or possibly dead and will be tried in absentia. 14 of them are in court, including the man believed to be the sole survivor of the 10-man cell that carried out the attacks. Salah Abdeslam fled to Belgium that night, abandoning his suicide vest. He was finally arrested there 4 months later. In court at the start of proceedings Wednesday, when asked to state his name, Abdeslam replied that there was only one God, Allah, and that he had forsaken all to become a fighter for the Islamic State group. ISIS claimed responsibility for planning and carrying out the attacks on the Bataclan Concert Hall, the Stade de France Sports Stadium, and several cafes and restaurants in eastern Paris. Lawyer Victor Edu, representing 8 survivors from the Bataclan, says it was very hard for his clients to hear Abdeslam's words. It was very violent, very difficult for them to take, he said, adding that they know the next 9 months will not be easy. But the survivors and families of the victims hope the lengthy proceedings will provide them with some answers. Maria Galivan for VOA News, Paris.
This is the Voice of America. The Lebanese presidency says a new government has been formed, breaking a 30-month deadline that saw the country slide deeper into financial chaos and poverty. Lebanon has been without a fully empowered government since the catastrophic August 4, 2020 explosion at Beirut port, which forced the resignation of then Prime Minister Hassan Diab's government. Rival political groups have been locked in disagreement over the makeup of a new government since then, hastening the country's economic meltdown. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. UN human rights experts say the international community is abandoning millions of Yemeni civilians to intolerable suffering and desperation as Yemen enters its seventh year of civil war with no end in sight. This statement comes as the three-man UN group of eminent international and regional experts on Yemen presents its findings ahead of a report to the UN Human Rights Council next week. Here's Lisa Schlein again reporting for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations estimates more than 1,200 civilians have been killed or injured in Yemen this year. This is on top of the more than 20,000 civilians who have been killed or injured since the war began in 2015. Additionally, the UN Humanitarian Office reports about 233,000 people have died of causes related to hunger, disease, lack of health care, a collapsed economy, and other indirect causes. Eminent expert Ardi Imsels says civilians continue to pay the highest price in this conflict as they sink deeper into hunger, poverty, suffering, and despair.
This year, the group of eminent experts continues to have reasonable grounds to believe that all parties to the conflict have committed serious violations of international human rights and humanitarian law, some of which may amount to war crimes. As we have said before, there are no clean hands in this conflict.
The group accuses the government of Yemen, supported by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and Iranian-backed Houthi rebels of multiple atrocities. The report documents numerous airstrikes in populated areas by the Saudi-led coalition and indiscriminate shelling attacks by the Houthis. The range of violations committed by all parties include arbitrary detention, enforced disappearances, torture, rape, and other forms of gender-based sexual violence. In view of the enormous suffering of the Yemeni people, eminent expert Melissa Park says the situation in Yemen should be at the top of the international agenda.
We're seeing with children, a generation of children caused irreparable harm, forced to be child soldiers, denied their fundamental rights to food and education, to health care. Yemen was already patriarchal before the war, but the situation for women has only become worse with the conflict and the associated displacement, extreme poverty, and indiscriminate violence.
The group says impunity for these crimes must end. Perpetrators must be held accountable and brought to justice. The eminent experts are calling on states to stop all arms transfers to the parties which they say are driving the conflict. The report contains a so-called non-exhaustive list of countries that are providing weapons to Yemen's warring parties. They include Canada, France, Iran, Britain, and the United States. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A massive manhunt is underway after six Palestinians convicted of terrorism escaped from a prison in northern Israel earlier this week. Five of them are members of the Islamic Jihad, and the sixth is a senior member of the Al-Aqsa Matters Brigade's militant group. Israel imposed new restrictions on inmates, sparking riots in the prisons and demonstrations in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Linda Grasstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The prison break is shaping up to be the first serious security challenge for Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's new government and one of the biggest escapes in Israel's history. The six men escaped from Gilboa Prison early Monday, taking advantage of a structural flaw in the facility in northern Israel, just a few kilometers from the West Bank. They were able to unscrew a metal plate under the toilet in their cell and escape via the sewage system. Officials said the escapees apparently received help from the outside and had a change of clothes and a car waiting for them. Five of the six are part of the Islamic Jihad, one of the most radical groups in the West Bank, and several of them were serving life sentences for killing Israelis. The sixth is identified as Zakaria Zubeda, who was a senior member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, a group that the United States and other governments consider a terrorist organization. Israeli troops have sent thousands of soldiers and police to the area to search for the men and extended a curfew that had been imposed for the Jewish New Year. They also halted family visits to prisoners for several days. Israeli officials believe the men are either still in Israel or the West Bank. Israel moved all the Islamic Jihad prisoners from the Gilboa facility to other facilities, sparking riots in several prisons. There were also demonstrations against Israel in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which included violent clashes that witnesses said were spreading on Thursday. Israeli officials are concerned the men may carry out a terrorist attack or kidnappings. Palestinian officials warned of widespread unrest if Israeli forces kill the men. Israeli authorities have also said that they expect Palestinian security forces to help them if the convicts have escaped to the West Bank. But the Palestinian governor of Jenin, Akram Rajoub, said that is not likely. He said that the prisoners hold a special place in the Palestinian public's heart and that he does not think the public will want to hand them over to Israel and will not help the Palestinian Authority do that. Israeli officials say they will do everything to find the convicts and capture them. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson. I am Gene Rolfo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.